population. Let's check in on their morale. How are people feeling as this war goes into another year?
Well, Ukrainians are incredibly defiant despite all of this. A new poll from the Razumkov Center, which is a really well-respected group that does opinion polling here in Kyiv, found that 9 in 10 Ukrainians believe in a total, unequivocal Russian loss. And about half those people believe it could come in a matter of months, just by the end of summer. Despite that overwhelming optimism, President Zelensky's New Year's address tried to insert some more sobering notes. He said, "We don't know what the new year has coming, what kind of attacks people should expect. Both sides have shifted their attention away from the south and towards the east, namely towards a town called Bakhmut. The Russians have been trying to capture Bakhmut for months, and they just haven't been able to. The fighting this week especially has been very intense."
NPR's Yulian Haidar in Kyiv. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And let's bring in Ben Hodges, the former commanding general of the U.S. Army in Europe. We have found him in Germany. General, welcome to the program and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Steve. Thank you.
So we just heard that survey. Many Ukrainians seem to think that victory is within their grasp within 8 or 9 months, end of summer. Is that possible?
It's absolutely possible, Steve, and I would say it's likely. I think that Ukraine has the chance to liberate Crimea by the end of August, the end of this summer. And once Crimea is liberated, which is the decisive part of Ukraine for this war, the rest would follow soon after that, because that would unleash all sorts of.
14. I'm just thinking of the tactical difficulty of that, General. It's a very narrow neck of the peninsula even getting on there. The Russians, you think, could not even defend that little space?
Well, of course, if this was the 18th or even the 19th century, that's how people would try to attack it, but that's not how the Ukrainians are going to do it. I'm glad you mentioned 2014, because here we are after 8 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. 8 years, Russia still controls only about 10 to 12% of Ukraine, despite having every single advantage. Will isolate Crimea by going after the only two roads that connect the Crimean Peninsula to the mainland. The most well-known, of course, is where the Kerch Bridge connects. And it's already been hit very hard, and I'm sure it'll be revisited several times. The other landline of communication is the so-called land bridge that runs from Rostov through Mariupol to Melitopol and to Crimea. And the Ukrainians are already able to hit that. So by doing that over the next couple of months, pretty soon I think Crimea becomes untenable for the Russians.
You're telling me that acting through the air or through the water, the Ukrainians can isolate and besiege Crimea until they give up.
Yeah, war is a test of will, and it's a test of logistics. And the Russian logistics system was never designed to support sustained land operations outside of Russia, but that's what they've been having to do for 10 months. And so they're trying to string it out as long as they can by feeding untrained, unlucky men into the battle around Bakhmut, as Julian just talked about. But also by going after the power grid to make this go as long as possible until we lose the will to support Ukraine. That's not working. And so the Ukrainians will be able to disrupt and degrade Russian logistics enough that Crimea eventually becomes a trap for the Russian forces there.
Do you see any sign, General, that the Russians are recognizing their own errors and making proper course corrections?
I think that it's a great question. I can't tell for sure what all is going on inside there. They have tried to fix one of their main problems, which was unity of command, by appointing this guy, General Serovikin. But even he does not have total command. Of the leader of the Chechens is doing a pretty good job of keeping Chechen forces out of the meat grinder, so that he is positioned in the aftermath to either be the savior or the replacement.
You're telling me that there's really not unified command, that people are still not putting everything on the line.
It is a very incoherent command organization. Not one day in 10 months have they done what the U.S. would call joint operations, where you had air, land, and sea operating together. Thank God they have not been able to fix that, and I don't think it's in their culture to fix it. Instead, they rely on what they did. They rely on what they did 100 years ago, which is mass artillery and untrained infantry.
And sending masses and masses of people into the fight. General, thank you so much.
Thanks for the privilege.
That's U.S. Army retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges.
Japanese cooking ranges from meals of zen-like simplicity to more elaborate cuisine. From
prefecture and came to Tokyo at around age 20.
I called myself a food refugee.
To be just another customer. She married the restaurant's then owner, Tasuku Ukon, who was 27 years her senior. She later became the eatery's owner after her husband passed away in 2012. Ukon's hands flit over the rice balls, stuffing them with filling, gently squeezing them, and wrapping them with seaweed. Customers can choose from more than 50 fillings, from standards such as salmon flakes and pickled plums, to non-traditional items such as pork and kimchi or bacon and cheese. The onigiri are made to order and served warm and fluffy with the rice slightly al dente. They're hefty, unpretentious, and straight-up scrumptious. Ukon says onigiri are special because they connect people.
It's not about the technique. It's about how much feeling you can put into each onigiri.
The music comes on and the customers pack in. After more than four decades in the business, Yumiko Ukon is still serving up onigiri with vigor and passion. She's clear about what keeps her going.
I thought about retiring at 70, but I'm still in good health, and I want to see the smiling faces of the people eating the rice balls.
The name Onigiri Bongo likens the restaurant's reputation to the sound of the drum, resonating far and wide, beckoning to those who hear it. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Tokyo.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning. President Biden has appointed dozens of judges with lifetime tenure for the federal bench, setting records on professional and racial diversity. But advocates press for more action in 2023. More details still ahead this hour on Wisconsin Public Radio.
The new season of Wisconsin Life on PBS Wisconsin offers plenty to get excited about. Host Angela Fitzgerald connects viewers with people whose passions, experiences, and expertise celebrate the best of Wisconsin. New episodes air 7 p.m. Thursdays on PBS Wisconsin. Episodes are also available to stream at pbswisconsin.org and on the free PBS video app, on streaming devices and smart TVs.
Support for WPR comes from the Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass in Neenah, offering glass collections, exhibitions, and programming. Bergstrom Mahler Museum of Glass is a WPR Business Cornerstone sponsor, providing multi-year funding.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WG on TuneIn.
Patchy fog clearing across most of the state this morning. Highs in the low 30s in the north and low 40s in the south. A storm rolls in tonight into tomorrow, bringing nearly 6 inches of snow to northwestern Wisconsin, freezing rain to the central part of the state and rain in the south. Highs in the low 30s in the north and could hit the 50s in the south tomorrow. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. And from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for more than 95 years supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And from Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on providing organizations with a system to continuously plan for all what-if scenarios. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. And from the ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Leila Faldel. Tis the season of resolutions and making changes in our lives, but changes take time, and it's one reason why writing down our goals is a lot easier than actually following through. As part of our series On Time, NPR's Allison Aubrey joins us. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Leila.
How do you stay on track? I mean, I write down my resolutions every year, and within 24 hours, I feel like I break them all.
Don't we all? It's them, right?
Yeah. So what does time have to do with it?
Well, if you want to accomplish something new in 2023, there's just 365 days to do that. One way to increase your chance, and loves to say, time is a thief. Every day, old man time takes another 24 hours from us. It just goes by in a snap. Yeah. And we tend to fill our days with routine, developing a new skill. That takes effort. It takes planning. And both of those require time. I spoke to Keisha Moore. She's a therapist who helps people navigate goals and how to set goals. She says the time piece is often overlooked.
Time management is essential to the SMART goal approach. If you don't have clear deadlines, if you don't have a time frame, you lose yourself in that process.
Now, when Moore talks about SMART goals, she's actually talking about a tried and true framework that's been around for decades to help people navigate their goals.
Okay, so what are SMART goals?
Well, SMART goals are based on the understanding that there are some fundamental things needed to make a change. SMART is an acronym. The S in SMART is for specific. What exact action will you take? M, measurable. A, achievable. You ask, is this goal actually doable? R, relevant. Is the goal relevant to your values or bigger priorities? And T, time. You ask yourself, how much time will it take? And what is the deadline to reach this goal? I spoke to Elliot Berkman. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon.
The way time figures into goal pursuit is that because goal pursuit requires focused attention, right? Our eyes and our minds need to be focused on one thing. That means it comes at the cost of other things.
You may need to learn to say no to tasks or commitments that distract you from your goal. Basically, in order to accomplish A, you may need to stop doing B.
Okay, but that's really hard to do because we have so many demands on us. And then it's easier to go after the easier thing to do than the goal you're trying to reach.
Focus on this new thing. Now, Berkman says, since much of our day is habitual, it's routine, this is the easy part. But when we set a goal, it requires a different way of thinking. This is where executive function comes in. You have to keep focused attention. You have to fend off impulses and distractions. And this is really hard work for our brains.
Goal pursuit is so hard as opposed to habits, because habits, you can do a bunch of them at the same time, right? We can listen to the radio and drive and chew gum all at the same time because those are all habitual, fast thinking. But the slow stuff is one at a time. And that's where it really time really comes in.
So bottom line, achieving a new thing this year is going to take time, and you may need to restructure your day to make it happen.
Okay, so really it's a big commitment. So I guess when we pick these goals, we have to be certain about what it is we want.
Absolutely right. Berkman says before you set a big goal, you should ideally go through a process of reflection, what he calls a goal decision tree.
The personal mission statement idea, I'm a big fan of that, and I think it's very evidence supported. And the exercise we do with our subjects is to walk people through their high-level core values. What are the things, the kind of abstract ideals that an individual cherishes in life?
So say your goal is to become more physically fit. Well, an external motivation may be to look good. But if you ask the deeper why do you want to be in better shape? Maybe you say, okay, well, my bigger goal is to be healthier.
And then I would want to ask myself, okay, well, why do I want to be healthier? Right? And well, maybe it's to, you know, try to live longer. And again, right, ask, okay, well, why, right? Why is that important? And at some point, you keep asking why until you hit the kind of highest level in this goal tree.
So you want to be healthier so you can provide for your family or spend time enjoying life with family. Value. Well, he says that's the motivation that can help carry you through. There's actually research to show that you're more likely to accomplish your goal if it aligns with the core value or mission.
Okay, so what about in people's professional life? Should goal setting work the same way with this core value and mission?
It can be a similar process. Therapist Keisha Moore says she advises people to write down their specific goals and then at the earliest opportunity, maybe through the annual review process, get on the same page with your supervisor. Develop an action plan based on how your goals align with what your employer needs or wants. Then throughout the year, you can refer back to the action plan.
It's there, it's concrete, and you can bring it up. So it gives you some negotiating room. It gives you empowerment.
You can organize your time around the goal, and then it's easier to say no when you're asked to spend time doing something that doesn't fit with this agreed-upon list of priorities. So bottom line, again, having concrete goals can make time management easier, and this is a key to success.
NPR's Allison Aubrey. Thanks, Allison.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Between Morocco and the Spanish territory of...
At least we're expecting changes, but it didn't happen.
I'm Elsa Chang. Spain, Morocco, and the migrants in the middle. This afternoon on All Things...
Story plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Good morning. This is Morning Edition on WPR. It's 8:29 on a Monday. NPR and WPR bring news headlines next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Ukraine's military says its forces have killed hundreds of Russian soldiers in Russian-occupied eastern Ukraine. The BBC's Hugo Bacega says Moscow is acknowledging losses in the Ukrainian strike, but it says the number of Russian casualties...
Donetsk region. The armed forces here say this attack, 300 others wounded. We can't independently verify those numbers, but the local authority appointed by Russia in this town has confirmed that an attack took place.
Earlier today, Russian forces attacked Ukrainian infantry. Who stood in line was American and tour guide Mountain Butarek.
It was beautiful. It was very touching. I didn't know what to expect, but people going in, they were praying the rosary, and it was just a very solemn thing, and the way it's displayed is, it's beautiful.
Benedict died on Saturday at the age of 95. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Wild rice, or Manomin, is culturally significant to Ojibwe tribes, and it's been declining in abundance. A collaboration between tribal managers and researchers seeks to better protect wild rice by prioritizing indigenous knowledge. University of Minnesota researchers formed a partnership with tribal managers in 2018 to study the decline. One report, collaboration honors tribal sovereignty.
When we as researchers conduct our earth sciences work without accounting for indigenous peoples, without engaging with indigenous peoples, we are perpetuating the harms inflicted on them.
Red Cliff tribal members say Ojibwe people's connection to wild rice and traditional indigenous knowledge need to be included with Western science. For the third year in a row, a record number of homicides have been committed in Wisconsin's largest city. Data provided by Milwaukee's police department and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel show that there were more than 215 people killed in the city in 2022. That breaks previous records, which were set in both 2021 and 2020. Before that, the Journal Sentinel reports that from 2016 to 2019, homicides in Milwaukee dropped by 30% and were well below the previous record of 165 set in 1991. The official number of homicides committed last year is likely to fluctuate some over the next few weeks as investigations are still carried out. Fog is clearing across most of Wisconsin this morning. It'll stay that way for most of the day. Highs in the low 30s in the north today and low 40s in the south. Another storm system begins to move in across the state overnight. It'll result in nearly 6 inches of snow in northwestern Wisconsin, freezing rain in the central part of the state and rain in the south. Highs in the low 30s in the north tomorrow could hit the 50s in the south. Precipitation continues into Wednesday, with northwestern Wisconsin expecting an additional 2 to 4 inches of snow, with rain across the rest of the state. Highs in the upper 20s in the north Wednesday and 40s in the south. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
And I'm Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Last year's economy was, well, weird. Inflation hit a 40-year high, interest rates surged, stocks plunged, crypto crashed, yet the job market remained strong. Let's ask David Wessel what to expect in the new year. He's a senior fellow in economic studies and director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. David, good morning.
Good morning.
One of the biggest economic stories of 2022, David, was the
4.25% this year. And it says it's going to keep raising interest rates, albeit at a slower pace, until it's convinced that inflation is headed back down towards its 2% goal. Now, some of the forces that have been pushing prices up are abating. The cost of shipping containers across the Pacific is down. Used car prices have fallen for 5 months in a row. Home prices are starting to come down. And that's going to pull down the headline inflation rate, but probably not all the way to the Fed's 2% goal. So Jay Powell, the Fed chair, says he's going to keep raising it level until the job market weakens and unemployment rises enough that employers don't have to give such big raises to retain workers and the inflation dragon is slain.
You mentioned higher unemployment being a consequence of this. What does that
1 full percentage point in 2023? That works out to 14 million more workers looking for jobs. Now, whether that means a recession, a shrinking economy, it's hard to say. It's going to feel like one for those workers and their families. There are forecasters who think the Fed can pull this off, can cool the labor market, bring down inflation without triggering a recession, but most of them expect one in 2023.
David, a lot has been said about the COVID-related changes in the workplace. I'm talking about, you know, working from home, quiet quitting, early retirement, these sorts of things. Will these trends continue in 2023?
It's a really good question and hard to answer. How much of what happened during COVID is temporary and we're going to go back to the way things were before, and how much is permanently changed? With so many work employers complaining about labor shortages, workers have been able to insist on all sorts of flexibility about working from home. But I think if there's more workers looking for jobs, more unemployment, the balance of power may shift towards employers, and it may be that they're less willing to be flexible. It certainly looks like a lot of people, a lot of office workers, will be working from home at least a couple days a week, and that really has really negative implications for mass transit systems, for commercial real estate downtown, for the people who sell sandwiches to workers. Meanwhile, there are an awful lot of people still on the sidelines of the labor market, not even looking for work, a lot more than before the pandemic. So among older workers, the decline in worker in labor force participation is among the over 70 crowd, not really early retirement. But the fraction of men between 25 and 54, mostly too old to be in school and too young to retire, has been declining for years, took a big plunge during the pandemic. It's been creeping up, but it's still far short of the pre-pandemic level.
That's David Wessel. He's the director of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
In President Biden's first 2 years in office, the Senate confirmed 97 federal judges at various levels. Because Democrats held the Senate in last year's elections, Biden has a chance to have the Senate confirm even more in the next couple of years. NPR Justice correspondent Kerry Johnson looks at the long-term implications for the law and for people's lives.
President Biden has spent more than 30 years on the issue of judges, first in the Senate and now in the White House. Chief of Staff Ron Klain has been by Biden's side through much of that work.
This has been a top priority for the president, and I think the record reflects that prioritization.
Klain says there's a simple reason why the president's focus on the courts is so intense.
When he talks about rights and liberties, he knows those rights and liberties are decided by federal judges. So the makeup of the federal judiciary is connected to everything else we do.
Already, Biden has broken multiple records when it comes to his federal judge nominees. White House lawyer Paige Herwig says the effort is designed to make the courts look like the rest of America.
We've confirmed 74 women as federal judges during this administration so far. That's actually more than were confirmed during the 4 years of President Trump's term or during the 8 years of President George W. Bush's administration.
That includes Dana Dug, first Black woman ever to sit on the Seventh Circuit Appeals Court from Indiana. In all, Biden has nominated and helped win confirmation for 11 Black women to sit on the appeals courts combined. Janae Nelson is president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Our federal judiciary will finally begin to reflect women in particular can bring to the bench.
Biden's first move on judges involved promoting Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C. Judge Jackson is now Justice Jackson. Last year, she became the first Black woman on the Supreme Court. She's also the first justice who worked as a public defender. That's another area Biden has prioritized. Christopher Kang works at the group Demand Justice, which advocates for court reform and progressive-leaning judges. Kang says the president thinks about professional diversity, picking lawyers who represent individuals.
They're public defenders representing people accused of crimes. They're civil rights lawyers. They're lawyers who are representing individuals who might have been discriminated against or harmed by defective products.
Kang says Biden has already changed the face of the federal judiciary in a way that could linger for decades, since federal judges can serve for life. Janae Nelson of the Legal Defense Fund.
The imprint that he has on the federal judiciary is one that might be the most durable in his entire legacy as a president, and is certainly one of the most laudable accomplishments that he's made to date.
This year, the Senate will remain in control of Democrats who have mostly voted in lockstep to support Biden's judges. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said they're just getting started. It's unlikely Biden can shift the balance of power on every federal appeals court in the country over the next 2 years. That all depends on time and retirements of current judges. And as for the nation's highest court, former President Donald Trump cemented a conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court, one that's already frustrated Biden's agenda on reproductive rights, climate change, and gun safety measures. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42 this Monday morning. I'm Alex Crow. The latest project from jazz artist Jason Moran revisits the work of Black composer and bandleader James Reese Europe. He's best known for serving with the Harlem Hellfighters in World War I. That's you, Morning Classics.
As deaths from overdoses hit all-time highs, treatment centers are struggling to handle the load.
We want all eligible members to remain eligible, but eligibility is dependent upon providing the necessary information to attend care.
I'm Kimberly Adams. Attempts to fill the gaps, next time on Marketplace.
You can hear Marketplace tonight at 6:30, right after All Things Considered on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from the DNR's eCycle Wisconsin program, reminding listeners that many electronics cannot be put in the trash and should be recycled. Collection sites at dnr.wi.gov. Search eCycle.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
For this Monday, at least two explosions have been heard in the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv this morning. This after several Russian missile and drone attacks hit the capital on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. For the third year in a row, a record number of homicides were committed in Wisconsin's largest city in 2022. More than 200 people were killed in Milwaukee last year. And a Dane County judge has ruled that people can sell a wide range of homemade food without a commercial license or kitchen. In weather today, patchy fog clearing across most of the state this morning. Snow moves to northwestern Wisconsin overnight. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, a personalized program based in psychology to help people understand a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. When the COVID vaccines first came out, mass vaccination sites had lines snaking for blocks. These days, that's hard to imagine. The few vaccination sites that remain have a trickle of people coming in, and that's reflected in the vaccination rate. Fewer than 15% of people have gotten the newest booster. Hi, Selena.
Hi, Leila.
Okay, so one problem with COVID vaccination these days is it's pretty confusing. Like, yeah. How many shots have you had? When have you also had COVID? Do you even need a shot?
Yeah, no, it's true. At the beginning, no one had had any shots, so yeah. Everyone could just line up and get vaccinated in one go, and we're just not synchronized like we used to be. Mm-hmm. So public health officials are dealing with all of that by emphasizing the idea of being up to date. So ask yourself, have you had a shot or a case of COVID in the last few months? If so, you probably have good antibody coverage. If not, you're more likely to get sick if you're exposed to COVID, and getting a booster might be a good idea.
I mean, that vaccination rate for the booster is dead.
The CDC is doing an initiative to put single-dose vials in long-term care facilities.
Okay, can you explain that?
Yeah, so this means that if one senior was ready for a booster, mm-hmm. nursing home staff could get a single dose out of the pharmacy-grade fridge and vaccinate on the spot. And it used to be that vaccines came in 10-dose vials with huge minimum orders. So this gives much more flexibility for getting people vaccinated without wasting doses.
Yeah.
So my sources also said, everyone out there, think about the older people in your life, your parents, your grandparents. If they haven't gotten boosted, make sure to get that done.
Okay, but what if you have to convince your grandparents? What do you do then?
Yeah, so vaccine hesitancy is complicated. People have lots of different reasons. There's yeah. misinformation and distrust and apathy. Experts I talked to say it's important to listen to each person's concerns and try to provide thoughtful answers. Dr. Kelly Moore, who's CEO of Immunize.org, told me she is interested in addressing hesitancy related to the vaccination experience.
Okay.
So she says most kids and about a quarter of adults are anxious about needles.
How many of those people who are refusing to come in for vaccination are saying, I don't want it, I don't have time, or I don't think it works? For how many of them is that really just an excuse?
So this hit close to home for me because my 7-year-old daughter, Noah, really doesn't like shots, and I wanted to take her to get her booster before we had travel coming up.
So did she offer any tips to try and make it easier?
She actually did. So she told me headphones can help, listening to your favorite music, deep breathing, or using this small plastic thing called a shot blocker to make it less painful. So what I did was get a lidocaine patch at the drugstore, and I stuck it on her upper arm about 30 minutes beforehand, and she said the shot didn't hurt.
Okay.
So there you go. In year 4, vaccination is really about each person and what they need to know or do to make the vaccination happen.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. It's 8:49 this Monday morning. More Morning Edition on the way next. Then news headlines are about 11 minutes away. Afterwards, host Stephanie Elkins brings you morning classics to start off 2023. That's all on the way next on Wisconsin Public Radio.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the United Way is in search of volunteers for its VITA Tax Preparation Assistance Program for the community's disenfranchised and underserved community members. For more info, contact KenoshaUnitedWay.org or RacineUnitedWay.org.
Guided Tour. WPR is pleased to support community connections to nature. Learn more at WPR.org/events.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. Thanks for joining us. In sports, the Packers beat the Vikings yesterday. If Green Bay beats Detroit next week, they will clinch a spot in the NFL playoffs. There are four college football bowl games on today. That includes the Rose Bowl being played in Pasadena between Penn State and Utah. In college basketball, the Badgers men's team will start Big Ten play tomorrow with the game against Minnesota. The women's team fell to Purdue yesterday. They'll play Minnesota on Sunday, January 8th. The Milwaukee Bucks lost yesterday as well at the hands of the Washington Wizards. Those two teams will play tomorrow night at 7. In weather, clearing across the state today with highs in the low 30s in the north and possibly low 40s in the south. A storm rolls in across the state tomorrow, bringing nearly 6 inches of snow to northwestern Wisconsin, freezing rain in the central part of the state, and rain in the south. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rob Schmitz. Those who think people aren't doing enough for the environment can take heart that they're receiving help.
This 13-year-old border collie is doing his part. Scruff is his name, and Scruff has collected more than 1,000 bottles over the past year for recycling in his town of Nuneaton in central England.
His humans, Yvonne and David Grant, did not think much of it when their dog first started finding and picking up bottles during their walks, but then it became a family affair.
It was David who suggested at the end of 2021 that we maybe start collecting them because he seemed to see that many, which brought our attention to it. And yeah, he's gone from there.
David Grant says there's never a shortage of bottles to collect.
Till I've since.
Scruff's bottle patrols are continuing in the new year.
The only difference is we think is we're not going to store the bottles all year. We'll still bring them home, try and keep account of them as well, but just recycling them on a daily basis.
While Scruff likes collecting bottles, the hope is that one day he'll need a new passion.
It would also be nice if he didn't find one bottle. Yeah. He wouldn't be happy because it would take away his fun, but at least the streets would be clean.
Yes, yes.
If that other happens, other towns might use his help.
American composer James Rhys Europe played a pivotal role in jazz history. He's just now starting to get the recognition he's due, thanks in part to the work of pianist Jason Moran. From member station WRTI, Nate Chinen reports.
History has always lurked and often loomed in the music of Jason Moran. His new album, From the Dance Hall to the Battlefield, is a tribute to James Rhys Europe, who brought an early prototype of jazz to Carnegie Hall in 1920. Is the University Distinguished Professor of Music at Miami University in Ohio.
He's such a pivotal figure, and his influence crosses all types of spheres, social, intellectual, musical, cultural, political. It's unfortunate that he has not received the kind of attention that he deserves because there's so much that can be gleaned from his life and his career.
Jason Moran has been doing some of that gleaning on stage over the last several years and behind the scenes, studying scores and reading accounts of James Rhys Europe's music. He's come to the conclusion that Europe is not only a key progenitor of jazz, but also a trailblazer in the fight for equality and in many ways a role model.
One of the reasons I know that his name gets pushed a little bit out of the limelight is one, there's not a ton of records. But I think the main one is because he walks in with activism on his shoulder, thinking about the well-being of Black people in relationship to the scale of the music.
That sense of social mission flows through Moran's new album, which features a range of ensembles and different approaches to the music.
It's the historical past and translated in a way that makes it relevant for contemporary audiences.
A case in point, here is Castle House Rag, which James Rhys Europe wrote in 1914. Moran and his band make the tune feel a bit like a funhouse ride. Elsewhere on the album, there are more poignant feats of translation. Jason Moran told me about one song that Europe composed on the front lines of World War I, along with lyricist Noble Sissel, who was right there in the trenches with him. They can be heard on this recording from 1919.
Hello, minstrel, hello, hurry, give me 403.
So they write the song, All of No Man's Land is Ours. And James is writing songs in the field, you know, with a little portable reed organ, because he initially signs up to this war to shoot a machine gun. He didn't want to lead a band. So they could kind of like push out these songs that are like so of the moment that.
Now I have come back home to you, honey, through.
The way they say all of no man's land is ours, that initially you think is about that territory to push the Germans back. But no, no man's land is America. No man's land is once you left Harlem and you went down Fifth Avenue, right? No man's land could be crossing the wrong block. And I felt that when they were going to arrive back to American shores, they would have to rethink those lyrics. There were songs that felt different for them, I'm sure, in Europe when they were playing them, and then when they returned home.
That sobering insight is part of what brings James Reese Europe's story into focus on this new album.
To the battlefield, and back home to you.
For NPR News, I'm Nate Chenin.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Alex Crow. You've been listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. You can hear Morning Edition each weekday from 5 to 9 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show giveaways, and logoed business gifts. More about 4imprint's dedication to customer satisfaction is at 4imprint.com.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.